Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Chris Casso.
Hello.
And, of course, Mr. Cole Hornaday.
Hello, my friends.
I almost said that again where I almost called you Nicole Hornaday.
That's okay, because we are...
the Cole.
That's right.
All right.
We own this.
How is everybody this fine, warm evening here in the Great Northwest?
We are a happy, happy few.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the days are getting shorter, but it is still that time of day where it is still light outside. And if you're watching the telecast, the simulcast, you can probably maybe see out the windows here and see that it's just the faint daylight holding on.
My brain sounds like a slight delay, so if you notice that, it's kind of like when you're listening to something on your headphones and the rest of the conversation comes
right
out. So just bear with me.
You mean like that whole interview we just did with Carl Kessel last week?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or whenever that is.
2 weeks ago.
It's 2 weeks ago now.
If you joined in 2 weeks ago for episode 229, and if you're just listening to that episode now, you missed the chance to... No, it's not sponsor Kickstarter. Support his Kickstarter for Impossible Jones.
I hope to fund it.
I hope he was able to be successful.
No, it's going
to
happen.
It looks a lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounded like something that he really wanted to have happen.
One thing that I neglected to point out about crowdfunding, about Kickstarter, is because if you listen to the episode where we interview Carl Kessel, he talks about this miraculous 11th hour funding that happened for the Section Zero book. But Ben and I have a mutual friend, Rachel Jackson, who had an extraordinary burst of crowdfunding support for her film Manos, the Hands of Felt. And it happened because Will Wheaton, the Lord God King of Geeks, tumbled her Kickstarter and her funding. Do you recall this, Ben?
I do, yes.
Yeah, it was like how much to jump? $5,000?
Oh, I don't know
like
the number, but I do know that
it was
made
extraordinary.
A significant bump.
Yeah, anyway, so you just need a nerd god essentially to just make a passing comment about how cool your Kickstarter is, and you are gold.
Well, I'm wondering if that's what happened with Carl's Space Section Zero Kickstarter, because he said that they raised like $15,000 in the last couple hours of the Kickstarter.
Must have gotten some buzz somewhere.
Yeah.
People were like, oh crap, I need to back that. I forgot.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
That could have happened too.
But we could help be that buzz.
Oh yeah, we're going to be that bump.
Are we going to be that buzz?
Well, we'll find out. We'll find out.
I just like the idea that there's like an internet god out there. Be like, you now. You get it.
Exactly.
You get to fund.
It pleases me.
Yes.
Speaking of things that don't please people, DC has a shuttered Vertigo once again.
They've succeeded in killing it.
I kind of feel like it's like Old Yeller. It's like
it's
put them down now.
Yeah,
it's true.
It's been a walking zombie for 10 years.
So I'm working on an article for the Holland Files, the Swamp Thing fanzine by our friend, created by our produced, published. What do I want to say? By our friend John Boylan. John Swamp Thing Boylan.
John,
that guy
we like.
And I'm doing
that guy we like, yeah.
Yes, that guy we like. And I'm doing an interview with Aaron Lopresti, who is famous for like, he's drawn a lot of things. But anyway, I'm writing the piece on Sludge and a character called Garbage Man that he did for DC. There's a lot of animosity I discovered in this interview I did with Aaron by artists working at DC who could not get access to characters who he said they were locked up by Vertigo. And one of the characters was Swamp Thing. He wanted to write Swamp Thing stories, but it was you know,
Vertigo was a walled garden.
Vertigo, precisely, couldn't do anything with it. So, you know, there's a logic to demolishing Karen Berger's little empire there. It's to get those characters back into the universe proper, so you know, they have access to it, which makes a certain amount of sense. It's sad to me, but he has made kind of disparaging comments about Alan Moore's work, and he wanted to bring Swamp Thing back to the Wrights and Ween type monster stories. I'm like, I get that, but yeah. So I didn't realize that was a thing. So there's a lot of tears being shed.
Well, what was the difference between what Vertigo was and what Black Label is?
Well, first, what is
Black Label?
Yeah.
I guess we have yet to find out, correct?
It's still going through its birthing pains right now.
Well,
it's teething.
When Alan Moore got his hands on Swamp Thing, he it ceased to be a monster book, and it even ceased to be an EC style horror book. Yeah. They started calling it sophisticated suspense because it was awfully brainy and awfully psychedelic, and it just didn't fit the regular newsstand titles. And I don't think it happened overnight. Chris, do you remember how the genesis of Vertigo?
Oh, at some point my brain did. Okay. We'll make another episode about that.
So is it something...
we can pre-research it again.
Something like a membrane where, like, you know, DC characters can go over to Vertigo, but Vertigo can't, like, it's too big of a molecule and it can't go over
to DC. I think that's a great way to describe
it. It's a one-way valve.
Because, you know, you get your Doom Patrol, but Superman shows up and is looking at that weird painting with the Brotherhood of Dada being like, how do I solve this? I don't know. This is not for me, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you got books like Preacher, and those kids are not going to play well with others in the DC universe proper. Yeah, yeah. They just are not.
And it just became an imprint.
It was just an imprint, and you could do different stories.
And certain characters.
Black Label seems to be able to do a lot of the DC characters and has predominantly done that. I don't recall anything that isn't DC characters over at Black Label right now.
Not yet. Yeah.
So a lot of that Vertigo stuff may get absorbed over there. Sure. It depends on how viable maybe it is to even continue. Well, it could be a good way for them to just cut any losses as well.
That happened, but that, you know, it started happening long ago with, you remember how crabby I was years ago about the whole John Constantine thing.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Because they brought him to DC and it was watered down. Right.
And I probably have wasted too much breath on venting my spleen over that.
But maybe he could live in a Black Label world as long as he doesn't take his pants off. You know what I mean? Which, with John Constantine, I don't know if that's possible, so we'll have
They
to
won't
see,
even but... let that happen in the Black Label world no more.
Well, I know. That's why everyone has to keep their pants on.
Well, I mean, they can keep their boxer briefs on, right?
It's fine.
I mean,
it counts as pants.
Isn't that a stipulation? Or their tighty
whities? Even skirts count as pants in
but
this context.
But just no batarangs.
Mm-hmm. No batarangs.
Below the belt.
Dan Didio says that even though Vertigo is going away, the spirit of the imprint that Vertigo championed in the books since the beginning will remain in books launched elsewhere at DC.
Corporate thing to say.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah. Cole, we were talking about this the other day, and you said that DC might have been just spiteful towards Karen Berger in doing this.
I don't know if it's true or not, but the hint I got from the interview I did with Lepresti was that I discovered some animosity that I didn't realize was there for those reasons.
I think it just hasn't been a viable option. Like you said, it was Walking Dead kind of for decades. Like once all those flagship sort of titles ended.
Yeah, Fables was gone.
Fables was gone. It. That was pretty much it. That was the death knell there.
Because they've tried twice now. And a lot of people don't even remember like the one before this most recent one. Because the most recent one had like, my brain dead. The
Mother Panic? Wasn't that one of them?
No. It had... Wow. So this is why we think it's dead. Because we can't even think of what happened. Because there was Hexwives. Hexwives and High Noon?
High Level. And there's Goddess Mode.
And so the thing is, most people have already kind of... Our sale numbers have like dropped pretty hard on all those.
That's another one of those where it has like a small, good following, but it doesn't really breach.
But there was a rebirth right before that, and like I'm not even going to try and remember those books.
Yeah,
nobody remembers
know.
What came out then.
Also, I'm kind of wondering if Image didn't do a good job of fulfilling those audience needs with their independent books.
No.
But yeah, I think a big part of it was the flagship titles, Sandman.
I mean, that was the bread and butter.
Right. Yeah. Sandman. And there were such powerful limited series like Preacher, Fables. They came to an end.
Why the Last Man?
Invisibles.
With Image and IDW and like the 50 other publishers that are doing that kind of stuff, there's no need for it anymore at all. So it's just like, go back to your superheroes.
There's already like two or three other Vertigos happening right now.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
And subprints of those have Vertigos because Berger Books and the other one at IDW.
DC Inc. and DC Zoom are also going by the wayside in favor of DC Kids. We talked about a bunch of DC Inc. titles that were announced at, I think, at the Chicago comic fair, whatever they call it over there. And so, I just think it's interesting where, you know, they're just going through a bunch of mad rebranding.
Yeah, there's been a lot of Time Warner restructuring.
Yeah.
Because they
heard he just had a new. They just got a new CEO as well. I just heard that through the grapevine.
For the DC.
For Warner Brothers.
So yeah. That'll make it even worse down the line. Yeah. Because they had a new person move into DC, and that's what happened with the Batarang. That she did not like that. And
the Batarang below the belt.
Yeah, Batarang below the belt. Jeez. And then. Yeah, just overall corporate restructuring because Time Warner got bought out, and I now forget who bought them.
Like Comcast or something?
Something like that. Yeah, so it's just going to be a little messy.
There's going to be two companies that run everything. Pretty much. It's going to be Disney and Comcast.
It's still going to be competition, exactly. So it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the DC Kids line, they're which that makes way more sense than DC Zoom. Because Zoom doesn't mean anything. I try to think about a toddler being really annoying and running around the house, and that's the only way I can remember it. Mm-hmm. So if you have to contextualize it, that's a problem.
DC Zoomies.
I'm hoping that the teen line just sort of folds into DC, and they still are doing those graphic novels, because those are doing fairly well, you know, and depending on the title, you know.
Yeah.
So it'd be nice that they would continue something along those lines.
Yep. No, they probably will. They now understand what the kids market and the young adult market is and that they need to get in there.
Because
Marvel's desperately trying to hit it and they're figuring out their pricing structures. So, like, finally, somebody at both companies is like, oh,
yeah,
money.
We've just been shouting at them for years and finally they're like, I guess we should do a thing.
Yeah.
Speaking of DC, Black Label, Frank Miller is pulling a year one on Superman. And I'm looking at the cover by John Romita Jr., and it's actually kind of a silly picture of Superman stepping out of out of something here.
Those are two artists I don't want to see on Superman.
So I was talking to a customer who is generally surprised by how much I don't like certain big name creators. And they had asked me, like, oh, what do you think about this? And I was like, I haven't read it yet, and I don't plan to until I have to, because I don't like either. And they're like, you don't like John Romita Jr.? I'm like, not for a long time, especially because he can't draw children and they're watermelon heads.
Oh,
and so he opened up the book.
The first two pages
and he started laughing. He was like, oh my God, you're right. I'm like, uh-huh.
And now that guy or that person's going to not see anything except those watermelon
heads.
I have actually liked John Romita Jr., but you have a really valid point.
I like him
and
best.
I was looking at the preview art going, this is just ridiculous. These proportions are frustrating to look at. They're silly.
Better than he's been for a while.
Yeah, you're right. Well, right, like Hit Girl and stuff like that, where
John
was all one big head.
I actually kind of liked him in that context, maybe just because it was off the beaten path, even though it was a superhero trope thing.
Boy, we just can't agree on anything.
That's fine, but once he did like Captain America and he did Superman, it's like, no.
Yeah, there was some advertising from DC saying the definitive origin. It's like, not going to say no on that one. There's been plenty of other good ones. Plus, I'm tired. Plus, Grant Morrison did it in four panels. So, good night. See you later.
Yeah, I hope you all brewed your tea tonight because we are spilling it.
So, this is six parts, four parts.
Three parts. Most Black Labels are three.
And Frank Miller gets to tell his definitive origin for the DC Universe proper, or is this going to be another one of his cruel, nationalistic, fascistic takes?
Yeah. To my understanding, Black Label don't count. Black Label is not in continuity. Yeah, it's not continuity. So it's funny for them to say the definitive. It's like, no, you're not. You counter. I mean, you contradicted yourself.
So, I guess, sorry, Cole, go ahead.
Well, I just was going to say something snarky about the All-Star Batman and what a brutal, sadistic piece of work that was. The goddamn Batman.
Hmm. So if Superman Year One is Elseworld, was Batman Year One Elseworld?
No.
Not at the time.
Have any other DC superheroes been Year One'd?
Yes. Right now, Flash is being Year One.
Oh, really?
And Black Lightning was Year One'd. And Wonder Woman's rebirth, relaunch, the sub-story was called Year One, I think. So Year One-ing has been a lot. And Miller and Romita, Year One Daredevil in the miniseries Batman Man Without Fear, maybe?
Daredevil Man Without Fear.
But they use Man Without Fear like every third year. So I feel that's the name of the one I'm thinking of. And that's when his art was good.
All right.
So to answer your question,
yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yes, yeah. I was wondering. I just didn't realize that
year one-ing was, you know,
it's a thing,
a verb.
They haven't done year zero, so
yeah.
Yep.
Well, speaking of end of years, Doctor Strange is coming to an end. Well, the current Doctor Strange, at least. Mark Waid and Jesús Saiz's Doctor Strange number 20 confirms it will be the last issue in the run. Doctor Strange, is it a seller? Do we care that it's ending?
I mean, they're going to relaunch it.
Of course, it's Doctor Strange. Yeah. I hear he's going to get another movie.
Yeah, and it's just Mark Waid's going to be busy doing like five other things pretty soon.
Yeah,
here.
He's doing History of Marvel.
So I'm kind of glad he's got a, you know, beginning, middle, and end to his run.
Yeah.
It's okay. It sounds okay.
I haven't read it in a while, but I know it was Doctor Strange trying to find his magic again. So hopefully it was like Doctor Strange got his mojo and he got his groove back. And
he's meeting Galactus and Galactus is meeting Dormammu.
Yeah.
Dormammu.
Yeah, was the Jason Aaron stories that I was digging with
Bacalo? Chris Bacalo?
Yep. Got really excited for the first time about Chris Bacalo's art, but then I kind of lost interest in Doctor Strange after that when the Bacalo... Jason Aaron, wasn't it?
Jason started, but they went to two other writers after that, and they got stuck in a crossover. So, like, two crossovers. And so, at that point, it's just like, moving on.
Yeah.
We needed a relaunch at that point.
Yeah.
All right. These next two stories are just people doing dumb things. Recently, there was a burglary at Denver's Mile High Comics. Approximately $49,000 worth of merchandise was stolen. And at the time, people who worked at the store were like, this had to be targeted because this person who stole these things knew where the expensive stuff was. Well, they caught the person who did it. And surprise, surprise, it was a former employee of the store.
Well, it didn't help that he also bled all over the joint.
It did bleed all over the place. Well, that's what happens when you smash a glass cabinet.
But like, also, I was reading the article going, man, this is uber dumb. It's like, because you worked at this store, you supposedly know the value of these, or at least the theft value in your mind, but you don't bother to be dialed in enough to the community to know that when you try to sell this stuff, people are gonna notice. People are going to notice right away, especially if you've got Avengers number one and these other books.
It's like a signed copy of a Spider-Man book that was important.
It's also, I mean, yeah, your point is you're right, because when, you know, if somebody steals a Mona Lisa and suddenly you find one on eBay, you know, you know where to look.
Yeah, you got a bit of a trail
But there's like, this store also had surveillance cameras. This guy didn't know there were surveillance cameras?
Sad girl painting. Buy it now. $5 million.
Free shipping.
Like A++, we'll steal from again.
Like, how do you put that one on the black market eBay? I just the titling of it.
Well, this story reminded me of this really sad event that happened. I think it was like, was it last summer, where the fella stole the prototype
Boba Fett.
Rocket launching Boba Fett from Rancho Steve Sansweet's Rancho Obi-Wan, which is the largest collection of Star Wars memorabilia in the entire universe. And actually, Sansweet is now the official Lucasfilm archivist of paraphernalia. Yeah. He's written numerous books and archives. But this person was on the volunteer staff at Rancho Obi-Wan, stole this $20,000 prototype action figure, and then, you know, found a buyer. It's just really, really sad, because this man not only is not a very good thief, because it didn't take people very long to figure out, A, that it was stolen, B, who stole it, but also he hit dire straits, and he's in this community of people. He didn't ask for help. He decided the best option was to steal. To steal from his community, to steal from his friends, to steal from people who trusted him. And I can't get my head around that. And I think you need to not pass go and go directly to dumb jail.
I just saw a documentary about this. Or something on YouTube. I've seen this.
Yeah, yeah, there was a video thingy. I read a big article about it.
Okay.
It the one you found.
And so, yeah, he's the Boba Fett figure wasn't the only thing he stole. He stole quite a number of things.
That was the one that stood out in my mind.
Yeah, but people, the Boba Fett figure is what got him caught.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's such a hard thing to pawn.
That's right. You're right. He'd been trickling stuff out, you know, for some time. But
the
I just
Boba
think
Fett
it's really
was harder to pawn than the Mona Lisa.
For sale.
Side note, Obi-Wan sounds like Denny's special promotional meal. Sorry.
So
that's all I've been thinking about.
Hard to contain that one, wasn't it, Chris?
Going back to Mile High Thievery, there's a person connected with the store whose name is William Moulton, and I thought that was pretty funny.
It is. And why is that significant, Ben?
Well, because William Moulton Marston created Wonder Woman. Yeah.
Look what we have taught this young man. Look what we've taught him.
Oh. Speaking of people needing, you know, wanting others to be taught lessons, so there's a new show based on a Neil Gaiman book called Good Omens. Stars Michael Sheen and David Tennant as an angel and a demon, respectively. I started watching it. It's really good. There was a petition that was submitted. I don't know where you submit petitions, but this group of people wanted the show to be canceled because they felt it promoted Satanism, and so they asked Netflix to cancel the show. Well, there's a problem. The show was on Amazon Prime and not Netflix, and I think Netflix had a really brilliant turn. They tweeted out, "You have our promise. We will not air Good Omens season 2.
Nice, yeah.
And then I think Amazon Prime hit back with, "As long as we don't, you know, air Stranger Things."
Right.
So.
And then Gaiman said something equally witty too, and I'm afraid I don't remember. Do you have it in your notes?
I don't.
Oh, bummer.
Unless it's in this.
Because
this
it's Neil Gaiman, and he's not gonna miss his opportunity to say something. Piquant.
Yeah.
Piquant.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Actually, so when news broke of the petition faux pas on Thursday, prompting a number of humorous responses, Gaiman himself tweeted about the controversy, cheekily saying, "This is so beautiful. Promise me you won't tell them."
Exactly.
Okay, and I got it wrong. Eventually, Amazon itself responded to the identity mix-up with, "Hey, at Netflix, we'll cancel Stranger Things if you cancel Good Omens."
This has just been really, really lovely. It's been really lovely.
They did. The people who submitted the petition did correct themselves, but it's too late. The damage has been done, and Good Omens is a really great show. Let's move on to Book Report, everybody. Nicole, let's start with you.
I'm not ready. We're never ready. So as of the recording of this, a new comic came out called Canto Number 1. It is published by IDW and all the creative people, written by David M. Buher, art by Drew Zucker, colors by Vittorio Astone. I like that name. That's good. And other important people. This follows a group of robot-looking slave people who do have internal organs, but the way that they are controlled as slaves is that their hearts are taken out and a clock is replaced with them. So they're kind of like these robot clock, but living beings.
As you do, right?
Yeah. They're not allowed to have names. They're not allowed to love or, you know, live lives. I mean, they're slaves. We follow this one character named Canto, who does have a name. He is given a name, and he has also loved. He does love people. There's a woman that he loves that he gives these little stones to. She loves collecting them and all that kind of thing. Canto gets in trouble. They find out about this whole thing, and the girl is injured, and now he has to go on an adventure to save her. When I first saw this in previews, I thought it was really, really cute. I really liked the art. That's what drew me to it from the get-go. Drew Zucker, I'm not familiar with that person, that artist, but I just really thought it was really cool. The character design was really cool. Overall, I did enjoy it, I think. There was some problems in like the paneling. Like, I didn't quite know what was happening. And it made me very present to the fact that so many comic cartoonists make panel work look so easy. They make it seem they make it seamless. You know, they make it really easy and flow. And how you know, maybe when you're getting your footing, or maybe you haven't had as much experience, that it can be a little bit difficult to depict certain things. So I just realized I took that for granted, and that was really interesting. And one of the things that didn't quite work for me, and it might just be, it's very subjective, clearly, where I'm at right now, I liked the idea of them being genderless beings. And I think I was a little disappointed to just find, like, a guy, he loves a girl, he's gonna save the girl. That's really just where I'm at right now, and not really a con to the story. Hmm. But overall, I really enjoyed the art. I'd definitely be looking at, you know, what happens in the future with it. There could be some interesting things. Of course, you know, we're going on an adventure is like the typical thing to start an issue one. So I think it was fine in that regard. And if you want something that's a little, you know, a little different, a little off the beaten path, the character design is very different. There's one other thing I want to mention. There's an older guy who Kanto goes to talk about stuff with, and he's got a little mustache, like a Fu Manchu kind of mustache, which depicts that he's older. Yeah. And I just thought that was really adorable, and it tickled me. Mm. So if this sounds interesting to you, definitely check out Kanto. Definitely check out the art. I think it's really cool. I don't know if you can follow Drew Zucker on the Instagrams, but that's where I like to check out a lot of artists. So maybe see if he's there and check it out yourself.
It's worth noting it's out of print already. Second print's on the way.
Oh, good. I didn't even notice that. I ordered kind of high on this because I was like, this looks cool. So I still got a good chunk of them. So, cool. Thanks.
Right on. Kanto. Thank you, Nicole. Chris Casso, what do you got?
I will do the one that made me happy, which is the one about deep existential terror. So Dark Horse has published a adaptation of H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness, adapted for and with artwork by Gu Tanabe, who did a previous one that's the Hounds. I've only made my way through half of it. It just came in the other day, and I've been reading it on the bus. But you know, it's an exact adaptation of a story I've already read a couple times. His artwork is fantastically detailed. It's also creepy, and not for the reason I think they might have wanted it to be. His human faces throw me off a lot, and so I'm a little bit more terrified by them than by like the horrible creature that's going to flay them alive at some point.
Is it an uncanny valley
it's
thing?
It's an uncanny valley okay. thing. There's just something off about their eyes and their lips continuously. Yeah. But he does these beautiful scenery backdrops, like where they parts of the book where I'm like, I can't envision this and I'm having trouble, and I think I'm supposed to have trouble because it's not supposed to be envisioned or else I'll go insane, but he does the hard work for me. And so they show some of those
non-Euclidean angles,
yes,
anti-geometry, yes, from another dimension,
that kind of stuff.
Excellent.
Really well done. And you know, parts of H.P. Lovecraft are very dry, so this helps moisten them up. I don't know.
Rehydrate them?
You got your, no, got your moisten. Pull quote right there,
this is,
man.
This is Lovecraft. Moisten's probably right.
Moisten before reading.
Yes. So it's a little bit thicker than a normal manga, not by much, and it's $20, so it's a little bit more expensive, but the paper stock is a little heavier than normal. I noticed it because I felt I could beat somebody with it. And it's got this beautiful like silver printing on some pages and some color to start with. So yeah, if you like Lovecraft, or if you want to read interesting adaptations, there's a really... it summarizes the point of Lovecraft three times in the beginning. I'm wondering if it's like the English version, then the Japanese version, but a translation of that, and then other. And then they even put a little thing mentioning, like, did you know that Guillermo del Toro was going to do one, but sadly can't do one right now? Enjoy! it reads like that. So it says, like, okay, thanks for telling me that. So yeah, $20. Dark Horse just came out, and it is by Gu Tanabe.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Chris. And finally, Cole Hornaday, what do you got for us?
I'm going to do, I'm going to hop out of my lane a little bit because I'd like to talk about a novella I read recently, written by a mutual friend of Ben Lawrence and myself. It's Scott Amore's Your Favorite Band cannot save you. And for those familiar with Scotto's work, you can only imagine how fun this book is. For those not familiar, let me tell you about the genius that is Scotto Moore. For years and years and years, he wrote some of the most high concept, loopy, bizarre, wonderfully brain-tingling live plays at Annex Theater. One of his swan song literally was a swan song. It was a science fiction, a cappella science fiction opera starring mostly a cast of women about a...
women, non-binary, and trans
right,
actors.
Women, non-binary folks about a... Was it a penal colony or was it escaped? It was a lost ship from a centuries-long war.
And it's sort of like a Wakanda kind of thing. They wanted to stay hidden, but they were found.
Yeah. And it was a really intriguing story with equally intriguing music. But that's the way Scotto thinks. Scotto thinks outside the box, and it is wonderfully refreshing. He did do an online comic with Eddie DeHaze, and gosh darn it, I can't remember the name of it now. I reviewed it on the show. We talked about it. We even had Scotto talk about it on the live show. Anyway, your favorite band, Cannot Save You, is a hot shot of Black Label whiskey from a different dimension a millennia in the future. It is wonderfully, wonderfully bizarre and intriguing. And you know what? It's only freaking 125 pages, and it blew my brain. I read it in like 20 minutes, and the only regret I have about it is it's so blasted short, and I'm starving for more. Let me read you the blurb. The band Beautiful Remorse is a hot new band on the scene, releasing one track a day for 10 days straight. Each track has a mysterious name and a strangely powerful effect on the band's fans. A curious music blogger decides to investigate the phenomenon up close by following Beautiful Remorse on a tour across Texas and Kansas, realizing along the way that the band's lead singer is hiding an incredible, impossible secret. Yes, she's a paradimensional demon from the distant future who's been projected into the past and is trying to, like, I don't know, recollect her power. It is so fun and is so packed with so many wonderfully bizarre ideas. It reminded me a little bit of the book John Dies at the End, which is by John Wong, who is aka Jason Pargan, who was once an executive editor and creator of crack.com. It's told in first person, not unlike John Dies at the End. Don't see the movie. The movie's ridiculously boring and terrible. But do read the book, John Dies at the End. And do read Your Favorite Band Cannot Save You by Scotto Moore. Cannot endorse enough. I think you can actually download the book, but, you know, I like paper things, and I like to read things, and there are some quotes in here I'm going to have to pull and make into memes at some point. Bravo, Scotto. I want to endorse your work. Nice. I enjoyed it.
Where can you get the book?
Well, I actually bought it at Emerald City Comic Con at the UW bookstore that was there. I imagine you can get it there. You can get it online. But yeah, go ahead and head down to the... We have so few brick and mortar bookstores in the city anymore.
Would like a Barnes & Noble.
I would try Barnes & Noble, but I would actually try the UW bookstore.
Yeah.
If you can go there.
If you're local.
But if you're listening from other parts of the country, go to tor.com.
Oh, it's through Tor?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Did I say that?
No.
I'm sorry. Okay.
But that works. Tor is through one of those big chains, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
But cool. I think you can, I know friends read Kindle versions of it when I recommended it online, and it's not hard to get your hands on.
Good.
You can borrow my copy.
Thank you, Cole. And Scotto's comic that he did with Eddie DeHaze is called Storm and Desire.
You can
find it at scotto.org, which is Scotto's website.
I wanted to say Fire and Ice, but I'm like, no, that's not right, and I'm not going to. Thank you for looking that up for me.
You're welcome.
It.
Well, that is Book Report, and that is our show. Coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or however you get your shows at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. And now, friends, get your quiz hats. It's quiz time. This week, our questions come to us from Nicole.
Laziest quiz ever. So one of my customers, Jeff, has this calendar that has comic book trivia on it. And I told him how much work it takes for me to try to do a quiz time. So he's just given these to me and shown me A Beautiful Mercy. So these are random questions that are in the comic book world, so they bounce all over the place.
Right on.
First off, what is Task Force X code for? And it is multiple choice, so if you want me to, I can read them out.
The Suicide Squad, but Task Force.
That is correct.
Oh, yeah.
The Suicide Squad. When
are we
going
to get multiple choices?
Yeah. Oh. I can read them out, but you know, I don't have to.
Did I just jump that?
Nope.
Yeah, it's okay.
Nope.
You win. Oh. You win.
You have to request multiple choice. Okay, when the government is employing supervillains, there cannot be enough secrecy. Okay. Next question. Who did Nick Fury encounter during World War II, foreshadowing the superhero era?
I mean, he met, like, everybody. Wolverine, Captain America.
I will give you multiple choice. Okay. Number one, is it Reed Richards? Number two, Howard Stark. Number three, Victor Von Doom. Number four, Dormammu.
Howard Stark?
Eh. Reed Richards, who is a major and a spy working for the OSS Fury, and the gang met Reed in Sergeant Fury and his Howling
Commandos.
Number three, September of 1963.
What do you know?
Next question. I sound so smart, don't I? What color was Iron Man's armor between the original gray suit and the classic red and yellow version?
Gold.
Also known as yellow. For a while, the monstrous gray suit was simply painted yellow. How many did I do?
Three.
Next question. Where did Groot appear long before he was a member of the Guardians of the Galaxy?
In where monsters roam, giants dwell, monsters that do things with Jack Kirby.
I want to just tell you that you're right anyway.
Creatures on the Loose.
That's probably right.
So here, I'll do multiple choice. In Greek mythology, in a monster comic, in the Fantastic Four, in a World War II comic.
In a monster comic.
Yeah, in a monster comic, specifically.
Cole's probably right.
But what monster comic?
Specifically, Tales to Astonish number 13 from November 1960. Groot was one of many monsters created in this era, including Goom, Grog, Troll,
Magoom,
Van Doom,
Goom, Son of
and
Goom.
Krang. How many did I do
and
it now?
And please check our latest episode of The Panel Jumper where we rattle off all the names of all those monsters.
I like the effects in that one. It's fun. You're just walking through all kinds of crazy stuff.
Give him credit.
You did a great job, Ben Lawrence. Yeah. Last one. Which of the following presidential comics is real?
Ooh.
Carter Corps, Reagan's Raiders, the Bush Brigade, Clintonistas.
Reagan's Raiders.
Do they have to be real?
Reagan's Raiders.
You are correct. Reagan's Raiders.
Wow. It's...
This gun-toting, swashbuckling comic was a crazed satire that appeared in 1986 from Salson Publishing.
Yep, it's in every quarter bin in every comic book store. Actually, it's probably in their dime bins.
And I have one more quiz time in the queue. So look forward to this ridiculousness and laziness next time.
Good job,
Nicole. I don't feel so bad about assigning you one then. Well, thank you, Nicole. That is quiz time. And that is our show. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.